You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You're listening to episode number 43 of Living the Dream with Rory O'Malley. If you like the podcast, subscribe, rate, review, do it.
Audition, side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
Hello, dreamers. Rory O'Malley here. Welcome to Living the Dream. Thank you for listening. This episode is weird. I'm just going to be out and out about it. I decided to just take a week off. I had family in town, a wonderful, wonderful week. And I wanted to replay my interview from 6 months ago with my buddy Josh Gad because he has a wonderful movie coming out that just came out last weekend, Marshall. It is so fantastic. It is so, so good. Go see Josh Gad in Marshall with Sterling K. Brown. It is such a phenomenal movie about Thurgood Marshall, a particular case that he took on. And it's great. Thurgood Marshall's played by Chadwick Boseman, and he's so good. I was really blown away by it, and I'm so proud of Josh because I think it's a big turning point in his career. He's had such an awesome, wonderful career playing the funny guy, and this is showing his dramatic side, which he's a phenomenal actor, and I'm really proud of him. So I'm replaying my interview with him from 6 months ago, and I thought I'd take this opportunity to answer some questions as well. So I asked on Twitter, ask me anything. And here are some questions from Olivia. I have, as a Broadway actor, how much sleep do you typically get a night? I think this is a great question, Olivia. What it made me think of, first of all, is every time I tweet something or put something out after the show, people always respond back, why are you still awake? You should be in bed. And it makes me laugh / kind of annoying because I'm tweeting something out at 11:30 midnight, maybe. I don't even leave the theater until 11:30. So when I get home, I don't instantly go to bed. I'm awake usually until like 1 o'clock in the morning. And it takes a little while to, one, just to get home, but to like wind down. Usually I have a little snack / another dinner. And I just kind of wind down with some TV, kind of calm down from all the crazy adrenaline that rushes through you when you're doing a show, especially Hamilton. So it takes me a little while to get to bed. I usually go to bed around 1 a.m. My husband would say that's a lie. It's not. That is when I go to bed. Sometimes it takes me a little longer to fall asleep. So I'll listen to a podcast or something in my ear so I don't disturb him as I'm going to bed. And then I try to get 6 to 7.5 hours. 7.5 is the magic number. Once again, my husband would make fun of me and said, yeah, right, you don't wake up until noon. That is a lie. I get a lot done in the morning and try to be active because you also just want to start getting your voice ready to go for later that night, especially if you have a matinee. So I'm usually up by like 8:30 or 9, and that might just mean that I'm stirring in my bed. But after 7.5 hours sleep, that's plenty. And I'm sure to a lot of you, you're like, wow, that's a lot of sleep. But for me, like I need to have sleep to do 8 shows a week, even when I'm just playing King George. It's just a big part of the job, getting enough sleep. So thanks for the question. I also have from Elder Zelder, what's your biggest insecurity when it comes to performing your job, if you have any? If I have any. I'm a performer. I have endless insecurity. What is important is to every day just walk right through that insecurity and step out on that stage. You know, as a performer, you have to prove yourself with every performance. You have to earn your place. And I certainly feel the pressure of that in Hamilton, that there are people who have waited so long to get in that theater, who have paid so much money. And I'm always insecure that am I ready to give them the performance that they've earned, that they're looking for? And, you know, I think that the way that I do it is just remember to tell the story. It's not about me, and that it's the work has already been done, and just to trust that and to rely on my fellow actors that we're a team. Even when I'm up there by myself, I still feel very much a part of a team. And that makes it a lot easier. You know, my insecurity is just self-worth. Not a big one. Then it says, what advice do you have on staying best friends with someone? That's from Mara. And she says, I'm looking at you, Josh Gad. I thought this was appropriate for me replaying the Josh Gad episode. Josh and I have been able to stay friends in this business and just in general because we care about each other and we stay in constant contact and we know we are always there for each other. And what a wonderful resource that has been through Broadway shows and college and, you know, just life. He doesn't live too far from me here in Los Angeles. And, you know, I'm over at his place for dinner all the time. They don't come over here for dinner, but they have better food. Gerald and I and Josh and his wife, we look at their friendship as one of the most important we've had, and we wouldn't be here without them. So, you know, I think that staying friends with someone is so important, especially in this business. You have to remember that somebody else's success is not your failure. My joy and happiness for Josh Gad gets greater and greater with every success that he has because I love him so much and I feel like it's mine too. And luckily, Josh is someone who shares his success and happiness with his friends and family. And I certainly hope that he feels the same way about me. I certainly know that when good things happen to me, Josh is the first one to call and say congratulations or be there. So we're both lucky in that way. And I think that, you know, just supporting each other is what's most important. Then I have the most important question here is from Sheila Burke. What Broadway actors would you cast for Golden Girls, the musical? Wow, I cannot wait for Golden Girls, the musical. I haven't thought this through completely, but I would say Bernadette Peters as Rose. I would say Bette Midler as Blanche. I would say, wow, this might take all day. This is one of the most important questions I've ever been asked. Who would play Dorothy? I guess we would have to say Patty. Patty would do a great Dorothy, wouldn't she? Yeah, Patty LuPone. And then for Sophia, oof, who would be our Sophia? Let's bring back Carol Channing. Let's do it. She's ready. So here is my conversation from 6 months ago with the wonderful Josh Gad. Please go see Marshall in theaters now. It is absolutely fantastic. And you can also see him coming up soon in The Orient Express, which is also coming out with our buddy Leslie Odom Jr. That's going to be a huge movie as well. So enjoy my talk with my buddy Josh.
I didn't know we started. I'm sorry.
No, we did start.
I wouldn't have outed you.
We started 30 minutes ago.
Oh, great.
We're halfway through.
This has been the best interview I've ever given.
I am. Well, that's a easy bar. Mm-hmm. Hi, Josh Gad.
Hi, Rory O'Malley.
Okay, you've already blown out the mic.
Is it bad?
Yeah, it's bad. You are already the worst interview I've ever had.
Hi, Rory O'Malley.
I was thinking...
From Carnegie Mellon.
I know how exciting this is that we get to... For you.
Yes.
To do my podcast, because you've been begging me.
I have been begging you. That's not, actually, that's not a joke.
It's not a joke.
I've been very insulted by the fact that you've asked literally everybody from every background, people that, like...
I've been looking for people that I'm interested in.
No, I can see that.
People who excite me, people who inspire me.
And I can see that you ran through that list. It took you a while, and now you're
Well,
desperate.
I know that when I asked Seth, you really
That really
went,
hurt.
I
that
know.
That really broke my heart a little bit.
You were pissed. You texted me immediately. Like, well, when am I going
to
be on this?
I introduced you to Seth. Half the people you've interviewed, I've introduced you to.
Now that is
no,
a lie.
No, I introduced you to...
To Seth.
Your husband. I introduced
that's a lie.
You...
Okay, keep going.
To your mother.
Oh, that's true.
I introduced
wasn't aware of her before.
To so many people who have... gotten to do this show before I have. I'm really, it hurts.
Well,
and I actually was on
are.
The phone with my agent this morning being like, I'm finally doing it.
I know.
Really excited.
I know. It's a big break. And as I said, if you would have done this before Beauty and Beast opened, you guys would have hit a billion in the first weekend.
That's what's so heartbreaking. Don't think I get a call every day from Emma Watson going... Why didn't you do it? And I said, it's
booked.
Not my fault.
I was booked solid.
I know.
I'm sorry, Josh. I'm sorry, Emma. No, I'm really glad you're...
This is, by the way, my podcast breath.
It's good.
It sounds like an NPR breath.
You get
breath.
Very good podcast breath. It's a hot mic. I can hear it. It's great.
You're a hot Rory. I can hear you.
Sorry, just going so poorly. No, I think this is great that we're doing this, but I am worried it's definitely the most boring episode for me.
Right.
I already know what you're going to say.
You know everything that I'm going to say.
I have no questions for you.
I understand your concerns about having me on because you do know all my secrets already.
I do.
And it's not fun for you because there's nothing to learn. What I would say is this is more about me than it is about you. There's some
Isn't it always, Josh?
Yes. There are some things that I want to air
Isn't
out.
It always?
There are some things that I want to air out. And what better way to do that than on your
okay,
show?
And we're not going to bring up college stories.
We
not
may,
on
we
this
may
interview.
Not.
Literally every interview we've given together, or really separately, anytime you can put it in, you try to embarrass me with college stories.
Because
and I'm not going to have it.
Your behavior in college was reprehensible. And I want the world to know what you did.
I did nothing. I was an upstanding collegiate
all-star. These are all lies. Do not trust
them. They can hear you. You don't have to get so close. all right. So this is called Living the Dream, Josh. It's about the ups and downs of this crazy business that we're in. And you've seen some high highs. Everyone knows about those high highs, but they don't know about your lows. I've seen you in those lows.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is actually a true story. So when I was, you remember this for sure. I had a healthy ego coming out of college, as you remember, which is, sometimes it's a good thing, sometimes it's a bad thing. For me, it was an awful thing because I was just like, oh, the world's going to be handed to me on a silver platter. And do you remember what my dream was? What did I want to do straight out of college?
Be on SNL.
SNL. That was it. Like, one
we watched
track
the 25th anniversary on a Saturday night in Hammerschlag together. It was just me and you. We were like, this is history. We have to watch this. Like, we loved SNL, and you were like, I'm going to be on it.
And what was so interesting is they didn't share the same ambition. And I don't know who thinks to themselves, oh, let me go to a four-year conservatory program. That'll be a great outlet to getting onto Saturday Night Live. But I had a very one-track mind, and I was sort of bouncing back and forth between New York and Los Angeles, remember?
Right.
And do you remember what you said to me?
I vaguely remember.
What did you say? Because I can tell you verbatim.
Well, then just tell me.
You said, I thought you knew all the answers already. I thought that's why you didn't want me on this show.
Well, they've heard me speak, Josh. You're the guest. I'm being polite.
Rory O'Malley said to me, you got to stop running away and find a home. You got to find consistency. You got to make your roots somewhere. That's what you said. And so I was offered this small play in Los Angeles, and our friend, our mutual friend, Ryan Dixon, was directing.
Right.
And he's like, come do this show, Josh. It'll be fun.
That's an excellent Ryan Dixon impression.
And so I did it, and I wound up meeting my future wife at the time. And it was the gateway to the consistency that would help define my career choices moving forward. Then there is one sort of constant in my life that I can mark as a way that I sort of got from point A to point B to point C, and that's Rory O'Malley. That's true, because you were also one of the first people who came up to me and said, I just saw this incredible show on Broadway.
Yes. Oh, I definitely, and you I'm said, still waiting on that commission.
And you said to me, you'll never see any of that. And you said to me, you need to be seen for this.
I saw it in previews.
Mm-hmm. You saw it in previews. I got a call from you. I got a call from Ben Wexler, Ben Peltison.
Yes.
Ben Peltison and you, Ben was another person we went to school with. And both of you said, there's this role, William Barfay, that brilliant Dan Fogler is playing. And when he's done, you have to do it. And I was like, there's no way they're going to see me for a musical. Uh-huh.
I didn't say that you have to do it. I said, you're the only person right. who can do it. I was like, this man is giving a incredibly unique performance and the only other person. I mean, I'd never seen anyone attempt to give that kind of comedic performance in a show. And I was like, you're the only person I know
weird enough to be able to do this.
Sensibility in front of an audience would go to that place. And
you
was
were,
right.
And you were right. And you were absolutely right. And you and I were blessed enough to do it together.
Right.
I mean, what's the craziest thing that I still don't understand? Well, up until Hamilton, you cheating bastard.
Yeah.
But up
well,
until
then I was with Leslie. So.
But then you were with Leslie. That's school. Right. Yeah. But we had done, or I've done every single Broadway show with you.
Yes. Two.
All of them I did with you. All two of them I did with
yes.
you.
Yes. So Spelling Bee. You mm-hmm. you were in it on Broadway.
You made your Broadway stage debut.
I made my Broadway debut going on for you me. As Barfay.
And you killed it, I heard.
Oh,
I,
yeah.
I saw the
you
show
You weren't
report.
There. You were auditioning for 21.
Was I auditioning for 21? Or was I auditioning for Avatar?
Something else.
Avatar.
Avatar. Oh, so it was a failed audition.
It was a failed audition.
Oh, that's even better.
They flew me out to LA to audition for James Cameron for Avatar. And I still remember the audition piece that I had to do. I was a translator for the Navi.
Okay.
And I had to say, Auve ut aria yohengehi nau malir tok CVE. And I remember that because I had to work with a linguist
what?
To learn it. And then.
And that's gibberish.
It's not gibberish, it's Navi. It's a real beautiful language that they speak on this other planet, Pandora.
Okay. All right.
And so I did this, and I was so confident because she's like, oh, James Cameron said to me, you know, what's so great about you when you do this movie is you come from the stage, and so much of what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to imagine. And then I didn't get it, suffice it to say. And I imagine that they like tried to test out what I would look like as like a Navi, and I probably looked like a fat Smurf. So
no, wait,
like
you were going to be a Navi?
I was going to be Sam Worthington's best friend.
Okay.
Who they wound up casting like a tall, skinny dude.
Right.
And he, you know, they have to plug in and become like, they wear those like Navi suits or whatever. And they become like Navi.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. Oh, okay.
So I would have been one of those, but I have a feeling that they saw that merchandise sales would go way down if that were to happen.
Maybe you can get a job at the Disney
Avatar World. Land?
Yeah, Avatar Land.
Maybe.
It's at Disney, right?
It's at Disney World. Hey. Animal Kingdom. Should I do it?
Yeah.
Walk around as like a...
We can definitely get you like a leotard.
And yeah. Blue paint for the face.
There's going to be like 12 more avatars, right? You still have
time. No, you still have a shot.
You still have time. Once they make it a musical, I think you're in.
So it's actually, they have made a, it's called Blue Man Group. It actually exists.
Okay. Okay. So we are in Spelling Bee, mm-hmm. which was crazy because.
And that was 2005, 2006.
It was a long time
ago. And I almost quit the business. Remember?
Before.
I almost quit the business before.
Not once you got Spelling Bee.
No, I almost quit right before Spelling Bee because I thought, you know what, maybe I'll go to law school. And my mom said to me, I called her up to tell her this, thinking she was going to be so proud. And she started crying. And she said, I'm disappointed in you. And I said, why? And she said, you've spent 15 years dreaming of doing this and only 3 years living out that dream. And I think that that's unfair to do to yourself. And like a month later, I got Spelling Bee.
Right. So, no, I mean, it's.
It's really because of you and my mother.
Yeah. We are a team. Mm. And we deserve all the credit. But it's funny because everyone has that story of being in that place where they're like, this is, it's too much. I'm giving this up. This is, it's overwhelming because that when you're in that spot, and it can happen at any point in your career, your journey.
You know what? It's really good. And I'll tell you why. There's nothing to harden you more than rejection. Mm. And I say that as somebody who's been rejected as recently as last week for a role that I wanted. You know, you never stop dealing with rejection.
Right.
But at a certain point, you can contextualize it. And at a certain point, you're not training yourself for success. You're training yourself to ride the highs and the lows so that you find a happy medium.
Right.
Where it's not so manic.
Right.
You know?
Every job or audition isn't life or death. It's just
another part of the... It becomes work. At a certain point, it becomes, I'm blessed to be doing what I'm doing. Let me put this money away because who knows? I'm banging on the table and Rory's telling me that that's completely not going
to work. It sounds great when you drum.
At Sirius Satellite Radio, by the way, you can get away with any of these.
You can.
Because they have actual technology.
Okay, let's not get on. My mic is a beautiful thing.
So you sort of train yourself to deal with that. And I didn't realize at the time, because I was getting rejected on pretty much a daily basis for things, you know, how useful and important that was.
Right. Well, I remember that period of time so well and what you were going through, not just because we were so close, but I remember, you know, I have always, and I'm only going to say this once, I'm not going to dwell on this.
I always had
a huge amount of respect for you and your talent.
Don't worry. The feeling is very mutual.
Okay, let's not get too crazy.
Love
here.
You. I couldn't do this podcast all the time now.
I'll only say nice things if it's being recorded. But I, you know, I was working in restaurants. I was struggling. I wasn't, you know, getting anywhere. And I wasn't even getting into the auditions to be rejected, you know? And I looked to you and saw that you were having a hard time, that you were, it was, you know, difficult for you. And I thought, you know, if Josh is having a hard time, it's okay that I'm having a hard time. And I mean that in the sense that I looked to your talent and to your what your career was going to be from the beginning, knowing that it was just a given, that it was going to be something that was realized, and that if it was going to take time for this industry to figure out who you were and how to bring you into the business, then certainly was going to take me some more time.
Thank you. That means the world coming from you. And I'll say that what I think what you and I figured out early on, which I always try to tell anybody who's young and who wants to do this, which is a very, it's a rough path.
Yes.
And you
feel like you are told that so much before you get into it.
Yeah.
And you don't know.
You don't know. The one thing that I think you and I did really well was we created our own opportunities as often as we could. And I think that that is so important. Nobody's going to serve you, you know, your career on a silver platter. It just doesn't happen. And so what you have to do is you have to generate. You know, what you've done so brilliantly with your cabarets and, you know, even early on when you came out here, you found the Trubies and you joined them and you...
The theater company that
you,
I worked with.
You made your own path. You made, you know, you did Groundlings. Both of us did.
And, oh, yeah.
Which...
Our Groundlings class...
Failed Enterprise,
with Seth.
By the way. With Seth Gable,
was in it. It was
right.
Me, you, and Seth.
All
and
stars.
we didn't make it.
No, we didn't make it. They were like, no.
No, we didn't make it. Now, not through the first class, the first session. Like, it's not like
we... Yeah. No, there was no... We were never going to join their, like, troop. They were like, oh, no, you're... even with the money that you want to pay us, we won't accept it because you're trash.
They wouldn't take our
you're
money.
You're terrible. so, you know, but generating your own opportunities is... It's everything. And I feel like, you know, you say yes. You just say yes.
Okay, well, that's the difference between me and you and what you're saying. I do say yes. I say yes to anything. You got a job, I'll take it. Yes, that's true. I think that I've gotten better at creating my own opportunities, but I think it's the scariest thing for me, and I have to push myself constantly. Yeah. You, on the other hand, have written, produced, forced your way into so many things and situations, and it has always been so impressive to me. And that's like when we were at college, you always every year did a show that you wrote, that you produced, that you had seniors when we were sophomores working on. You're never afraid to extend what your idea is to a group of people around you, artists, and kind of make it a collaborative effort and say, hey guys, this is what we're doing now. And I've always been so impressed with that. I always found myself all of a sudden I'm playing Dick Cheney in your show.
You were the most brilliant Dick Cheney.
Well,
do you remember your song?
I don't.
I don't either.
I remember I had multiple heart attacks.
Yeah.
That's...
you know, again, I felt like at Carnegie Mellon, there was an amazing opportunity because of the sheer collection of talented people around us that we didn't necessarily have many opportunities to all work together on stuff. No. And I thought, what a brilliant collection of talent. What, you know, we have all of these things at our disposal. And so you just pick up a typewriter or a computer and a pen and paper, and you just start writing.
Okay, sure. But where I stop is I'm scared. The fear of this is whatever I'm writing shouldn't be released to the public, for God's sakes. Like, what is it in you that was so fearless from the get-go? I think, obviously, your high school experience and your speech career, you were a national champion how many times?
Three times. And it was... that definitely helped. I mean, I would say, you know, speech and debate was great because it's competitive.
Yeah.
So, you, again, you're dealing with... rejection. You're dealing with trying to rise above a lot of talented people who are also vying for that same championship.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways that did harden me. I have an incredible fear of failure. Mm-hmm. You know, it is painful to do something that is not well received. It is painful to do something that falls flat on its face. I'll never forget my first time on The Daily Show. I was so terrified. And in hindsight, I can say I was absolutely awful. I mean, awful. And I was trying to be something that I wasn't. And I had two choices. I could either give up and say, I'm never going to be good enough, or I could learn from it, watch it, like a sports player would do. Watch it and say, how could I make this better? What could I do to make this better? And then the second opportunity I got, I said, I'm not going to waste it. And I felt like it was the best thing I had ever done on The Daily Show to this day. And it was this gun piece that I got to do that was, you know, about, it was about guns as an investment. And I was just true to myself. I wasn't trying to be, you know, Stephen Colbert. I wasn't trying to be, you know, any of these other guys. I was trying to be Josh Gad and do what I could do. And so I'm right there with you. I'm always terrified. I'm always terrified that I'm going to not be good enough. But I'm at a point, or I got to a point along the way where I said to myself, okay, that could have been better. I'm going to, I won't know if it'll fail though, unless I try it. And that's where I'm at now. You know, I have to try. Some things work, some things don't.
Right.
You know, but you keep trying.
Right. If you don't try, you're not going to find out either way.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I feel like that's something that I've been able to learn and grow in. I just feel like you had that at 18. I really feel that. Like, I feel like it's a huge part of your success is that even through that fear, you have the courage just to like walk right through it and not give a damn what anybody thinks about you artistically.
I think, you know, look, I think some of it is luck. I think I've been very fortunate. You know, I think we both have been very fortunate. Yeah. Right place, right time. That's a thing. Mm-hmm. But I do think to a certain extent, you know, there's a fearlessness that you have to have. Mm-hmm. That you just have to have. And I still get terrified. I still get so... Before I walk out onto a stage, I'm always so nervous.
Right.
I don't want to screw this up.
Me too.
You know? And it doesn't matter that I've done it hundreds, if not over a thousand times.
Yeah.
I'm still scared. That's part of the reason I haven't gotten back on a stage since Book of Mormon, mm-hmm. is I'm worried about the expectation of following up something like that. You have literally been blessed with being in the biggest shows of all time, one by one by one. It's scary for me because I don't know how to follow that up, and I desperately want to, and I know we always talk about wanting to do something again together, and so that... Even though I am fearless to a certain extent, I'm not. I'm still always afraid. You know better than anyone. Mm-hmm. I'm a neurotic mess.
Right.
And my neuroses are worn on my sleeve.
Well, that's what makes it more impressive to me, though. I you know, no one is without fear. It's if you step through it, if you can get to the other side of it and actually conquer it. And that's what makes it more impressive and courageous. And I think you've always had that in a way that is just like, it was astounding to me from a young age, and it's always inspired me, and I'm done complimenting.
Okay, good. Because it's making me really uncomfortable.
Okay. So you go through the spelling bee, you have the Avatar audition, doesn't go well. James Cameron does the old switcheroo with the tall,
old
skinny guy.
Switcheroo.
But you do get a movie, 21, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden you are in TV film world.
Yeah.
And what was that transition like? And
what was interesting? So going from stage to TV and film was a shock to the system in some ways, because you know this, Carnegie, as amazing as it is, trains you for one thing really well. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to film and television, I think it's changed since we went to school. When we went 70 years ago. But, you know, it's a different beast altogether, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't necessarily know what hitting my marks meant. And, like, there's a lot of learning curves. So I fell into 21, which was a great success. And then I did a show called Back to You on TV, which
Kelsey Grammer, Patricia Heaton,
yeah, Ty Burrell, Fred Willard,
the
creative team behind Modern Family. It had every recipe for success,
yeah,
except for one thing. It wasn't a success, And
well, it was also during the writer's strike.
So it was during the writer's strike, and within 1 week, I had my wedding, my show was canceled, and my grandmother died suddenly in her sleep. And again, I was back to square one. I felt like everything I had worked towards, everything that I had thought was now finally, like, I'm good. Mm-hmm. It all had been upended. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of felt like I was back to square one. I also had kind of fallen into this, not trap, but I'd fallen into this proverbial, you know, typecasting that worried me a little bit of playing the best friend or that nerdy guy.
Right.
And I got nervous about that. And around that time, I got a phone call saying, from Bobby Lopez, saying, I'm working on this new musical.
Did you know him?
So I'll tell you the story. So Bobby calls me up and he goes, I'm working on this new musical with the creators of South Park,
right,
about Mormons. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, they're adapting the Mormon episode, right, of South Park.
Yeah.
And they want me to play Cartman or something.
Dum, 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 dum,
dum, dum, dum, dum, dum, dum, dum, dum. And so I'm like, oh, that'll be fun. Bobby apparently heard this album that we did for...
Oh yeah, Carols for a Cure.
And he was blown away by my voice. And he's like, oh, this guy can really pull this off. He's incredible.
Right.
It was only later that he realized that the person he listened to was not me. It was an actor named Barrett Foa. And I was the one who was like doing a bad Bono impression on the album instead. So thank you, Barrett, for getting me Book of Mormon. I owe you big time. But I got this call, and they send me the demo, and the first song comes on, and it's, hello, my name is, and I'm like, oh, this is hilarious. Second song is, 2x2, we got, and I'm like, this is brilliant. And then it gets to a song called Vasadiga Ilahai, mm-hmm, and I listen to that song, and I remember stopping it and feeling sick to my stomach and calling up my agent and saying, I don't know if I can do this. And he said, why? And he goes, because I'll get shot in the face. The things that they're saying about God are not...
So he didn't tell you that that was...
No.
Wow.
No. Huh. So I was like, this is not good. Because you can get away with it in animation, but live performers performing for a live audience...
Yeah, that was the big question. It's a
very big question. I show up to the first rehearsal, and guess who's there? And what Rory won't tell you, because he's so modest, is Rory shows up to that first rehearsal... with our other friend, Will Taylor, mm-hmm, who did the first, mm-hmm, one with us, who also went to Carnegie with us. And he was in the ensemble. And Trey and Matt immediately were so blown away by him that they created the role of Elder McKinley specifically for Rory O'Malley. That role never existed. And then they saw Rory performing, and he had such a spark and charisma about him.
And was so gay.
That they were like, we need to create an entire role. And up until the very last, up until like the last week before we opened, they were still trying to shoehorn more and more songs in for Rory. Because they were... Rory was so brilliant that they just kept trying to write more and more.
We definitely had some cut songs, cut zero, little ditties.
Yeah, zero there was baptisms.
Yeah, that did it. We almost had a little ditty in there for McKinley, but it was a crazy experience creatively, because it was 3 years. We did 3 readings, 2 workshops.
Yeah,
and every single one was like, this is unbelievably good, and but it still felt like, Is this going to happen?
And even if it does happen, is anyone going to see it? Like,
you had the most pessimistic view.
Was so pessimistic. I said, I knew I had to do it. I knew it was beyond special.
Yeah, we all knew that it was so good.
But I thought it was going to get picketed. Remember, yeah. I was terrified about security.
Shock.
and so I was like, are we going to survive this if we do it? And I also thought South Park fans will come, but will New York audiences, will tourists come
I totally thought the same thing. You know, I always tell the story, like Gerald asked me how long I thought Book of Mormon would run before we opened. And I said, if we run a year, I would be so happy.
Yeah.
And he was like, you're an idiot. It's going to run forever. It's brilliant. And
I agree. And Trey and Matt never bat an eye.
No.
They knew, they were like, just trust us. It's going to work.
Well, and it's also, I think, because they certainly didn't write something that was like, this will be the formula for something that will run forever.
Right.
They wrote like, oh, wow, you mean there's no censors and we can do whatever we want to tell this story and just make... They're only concerned about storytelling. Even more so, I think, than being funny.
It is. We had the most incredible creative team behind that show. I mean, from going to the top, from Ann Garofino, who produced it, to Scott Rudin, to, you know, Bobby and Trey and Matt. They all complemented each other really well.
Yeah.
And I think that the special secret sauce is that each of them was the right person for the right job, all working in conjunction together. A big shout out has to go to Jason Moore as well, who directed the first two or three workshops.
Readings.
Who I think really helped shape it to some extent and give it that heart that it has.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Casey Nicolau comes in and does his brilliant thing with it and really, you know, helped elevate it.
Well, I always say, like, he gave it a shot of adrenaline in its arm and it like, really took off.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, once we got to that final workshop and Stephen Sondheim was in the audience.
Oh, my God.
For a workshop, you know, it was like undeniable that
we
were a part of something that was extraordinary.
It was extraordinary. Stephen Arimus as well, a huge contributor to.
Yes, he's been on the podcast.
So. I know he has. I know everybody has.
Everyone has.
For me. Yes. So, you know, it was this turning point in all of our lives because. It had answered that question that I had been searching for, which was, now I've found success, but how do I get out of this sort of bubble that I'm in of people coming to me for these same roles that just wasn't fun? And Elder Cunningham was everything that I do, you know?
Right. But it is actually, it's funny, that's literally what the story is, you being... coming out of the shell of just being the sidekick best friend and becoming the leader of the show.
That's
the story.
It is the story. I have to admit something.
Okay.
Okay. And I don't know if I've told you this. I may have. I have based loosely two roles on Rory O'Malley in my career. This is true.
I think you've said this recently.
I did say it recently.
And then somebody...
But I don't think I
don't know what you're talking about.
I don't think
about.
I've
you never
spoken
said that
to you about it.
No, you haven't.
So
this is like... Lawsuit.
This is lawsuit time. I based the voice of Cunningham, that sort of, oh, shucks, Midwesterner kind of thing, on you.
On your impression of me.
On my impression of you. That is correct. And the first time I sat down with the script and I was trying to figure out, who is this guy? What do I want him to sound like? And it, you know, my impression of Rory was always, hi, I'm Rory. I'm gay. That kind of thing.
I'm from Cleveland.
And so I was absolutely plugged in to that.
Right.
The second role that I based on you is completely based on you. Can you guess?
No, I don't know what you're talking
about.
I'll
give you a hint. Hi. I'm Olaf.
No.
Completely based on you. There's nobody I know who's more pure.
Okay, well,
innocent.
I'm definitely getting my lawyers involved. I mean, this is...
You should be grateful. I'm giving you... But I based Olaf on you.
Okay.
Because you have a purity about
you. Is this about how pasty white I am?
It is. It is about the fact that you melt in heat and you're completely
based
on
I'm very round.
But when the director said to me, find the most joyous, innocent, naivete that you can tap into. The image that came to me was you, and I was like, okay.
The most naive person.
The most naive person that I know. And it really was, I'm very grateful because you have helped me create probably my two most iconic roles.
That's so wonderful. I'm so glad that you got those jobs that you were like, wow, who would be perfect for this? Rory. Okay, that's all right. No, I
had to come clean.
I appreciate that. That's a beautiful.
I'm sure you've based something on me that is offensive.
Nothing. I would. Right. I just haven't really gotten into the darker roles yet.
Yeah, you will.
I will.
You'll play a Jewish
like a murderer.
Yeah.
A really
dark,
neurotic, sinister, crazed killer.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait. I can't wait to see what you do. So I did Book of Mormon with you, and it changed our lives. We were suddenly everywhere. We were the, toast of the town, and it was people coming up to us and being like, oh, what do you want to do? And with that kind of attention,
what do you want to do next?
Like, what do you want to do next?
Yeah. Which is, when Nikki was on again, another person who's on before you, we talked a lot about that pressure.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
That sounds great, but it's actually very tricky.
Yeah.
And I made some wrong decisions. I sort of did stuff that was, I thought, safe, or I thought was, let me get a paycheck, let me do that, instead of stuff that felt like it was coming from the right place. Like, I was making choices that were going to help, tell a certain story of what I wanted to do with my career.
Right.
I was very proud of the fact that I helped create a show called 1600 Pen, which you were brilliant on. And I was very proud of, the fact that I did some of these movies. But at a certain point, I did them for the wrong reasons. I wasn't after creating something that was creatively as appealing to me as I think it might otherwise have been. And that was a really valuable lesson. Because when you do that, it backfires sometimes. And, it was, and sometimes you'll go in with the best intentions, and you'll think, this is really special, this is really different, and it still doesn't work, and that's okay. But the motto of my life has always been take risks, and I felt like during that particular period of time after Mormon, which was at that point the biggest risk I had taken, because I turned down a lot of TV opportunities to do Book of Mormon for a minimal paycheck, as you know.
Yeah.
I stopped living by that motto and fell into a little bit of a rut where I wasn't necessarily content with some of the things that I was doing.
But it's so hard to come to the moment of a Book of Mormon or something that is like the world is being presented to you and not feel, after knowing how hard and long it took for you to get there, not being like, I have to jump at the first opportunity that comes along because I know how precious this moment is and that it can go away like that.
Yeah, exactly. And that was really tricky. I mean, it was, I would do things differently probably. I don't regret anything. I had the best time on all the projects that I did, but I definitely was a hamster in a wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was chasing something that wasn't there.
Yeah.
So I went through that period and then I was blessed enough to get, another incoming phone call. I had done a reading before Book of Mormon of a Disney project called Anna and the Snow Queen. And at the time, the music was by Alan Menken, and it was a completely different story.
Huh.
Anna and Elsa were not sisters. In fact, the only consistency was probably this little snowman character that they had called Olaf, who was like a henchman for Elsa in the original script. That project goes away because Princess and the Frog wasn't the gigantic hit that they were hoping for. And so it sort of put this, they started to worry about making princess movies.
Right.
And then Tangled comes along and does incredibly well. And then once again, this Anne and the Snow Queen project is greenlit. And so I get this call to do this. And at the time, I'm supposed to do this other project for DreamWorks.
Right.
And basically, Jeffrey Katzenberg it doesn't want me to do both for obvious reasons. They're going to come out within a month of each other. And my team says to me, you can't do both. It's one or the other, and you're doing this other project. And so this is what I mean by taking chances.
Right.
So I said to them, I'm not willing to take no for an answer. And I called up Jeffrey Katzenberg myself, which was...
Okay, remember when we were talking about the, like, fear thing?
Yeah. Well, this is when it comes in handy.
Okay.
And I'm like, nobody's going to defend myself better than me. And I really want to do this.
Right.
And so I called him up and I said, look, this is something that I really want to do as a favor to Bobby Lopez and his wife, Kristen, who are now writing the music. We just worked together on Book of Mormon. It is not the lead character. It is definitively a side character. Is there any way that you can let me do both? I would be forever grateful. And he was generous enough to say, yes, there is a way. If you don't do publicity, you don't do marketing, I'll let you do it. And my heart sort of sank a little bit, but at the same time, I'm like, okay, it's something. And I went back to my agent and I told him this, and he goes, there's no way that they will agree to this at Disney. And God bless the incredible John Lasseter.
Wow.
Because he took that challenge and he ran with it. And he said, all right, well, if that's the case, then we'll make it a thing where people will have to guess who played Olaf, and we'll make it a fun thing, and somehow convince the lawyers at Disney to allow it to happen. And thank God, because the other project disappeared and Frozen became Frozen. And so it was a very crazy and tumultuous experience, but ultimately wound up being one of the great moments in my career. But okay.
You know, that stresses me out just hearing that story. Like, how, when you get on the phone with Jeffrey Katzenberg, how do you find the composure or the self-worth to say, we gotta do this? And because to me, as an actor, I think there are 1,000 people they could get to do this. They don't need me. Where do you, I mean, obviously that builds as you get more and more it secure does, with yourself, you know, but you know what I'm talking about?
Do you remember what happened when I was first offered Spelling Bee in San Francisco?
Yes, I do.
I turned it down.
Yes, you turned down.
I'm crazy. So I would not recommend this. Like, I was not a working actor.
Right.
And they offered me Spelling Bee in San Francisco. And I don't know where these balls came from, but I had the gall to say no.
Right.
Because I was like, if I'm not doing it on Broadway, this isn't the career path that I want. I don't want to travel and do a tour. That's not what I want to do.
Right.
And I was such an egotistical bitch for even thinking that I was worth the time of day to say no to them.
Well, it worked.
It did work, but that could have backfired greatly and almost did.
Because, you know, that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm the yes guy. I would have said, yes, and you need me to hand out flyers in between shows. Yes.
Well, you
like,
know,
that's that. At
a certain point, you stare opportunities in the eye and you say, look, what's the pros and cons of this? And I always go through the pros and cons. And for me, the worst that could happen if I called up, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg, was he'll say no.
Right.
And that's where I was anyway. And sometimes it's worth the risk and sometimes it's worth the shot. And in that case it was. And again, it could have backfired.
Yeah.
But, you know, life comes at you fast and you just have to make a decision and you have to allow yourself to put yourself in a situation where you know it could fail. Right?
Right.
And I don't, again, I think the more I do this, the more at peace I am with failing. The more I'm willing to put myself out there knowing that I could fall flat on my face.
Right.
And so that was one of those things where I was like, let me weigh it out. And there weren't, it couldn't, I was sitting on a no anyway. So it wasn't like, it's going to, you know, if I got another no, it's going to make a difference.
It's not going to make it worse. But you do the movie Frozen, and it turns into not just a hit, but something that revitalizes an entire medium of Disney animated.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, Tangled had come out before Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah, but yes, those are big movies. But like,
it was and is a, like Mormon, a pop cultural phenomenon.
Yeah,
that can't be disputed. And with that, it is always a very strange thing, especially walking down the street and seeing kids recognize you for voice work that you've done, which is very surreal.
Or walking through Disneyland,
right?
Which I've done with you. Which I was like, oh, please, Josh, no one's going to know that it's you and that it was like swarms.
Oh, it's surreal. And you know, it's something that I pinch myself that I get to be that. For so many kids, because you know what Disney meant to me as a kid.
Yes, you had a framed letter from Michael Eisner that you got on your bar mitzvah on our wall in our college dorm room.
Yeah. I mean, like, what I've always been amazed by with the company, and specifically with Walt Disney, who is one of my idols, and I really do believe that John Lasseter is the reincarnation of that man. It's this ability to cross over into so many different generations, cross over and have such appeal to people who are 90, to people who are 2, to people who don't speak any English, to people who only speak English, you know, to people who suffer from, you know, incredible disabilities, to people who are, you know, successful athletes. There isn't anyone in the world that you can look at and say, oh, I don't know or love Mickey Mouse. And there's something about that that's very unique. And to be a part of that legacy is something I'm incredibly proud of, because, again, my grandparents grew up as kids watching Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. My mother grew up as a kid watching The Jungle Book. I grew up as a kid watching The Little Mermaid. My kids are growing up watching Frozen. And so these touchstones become seminal moments in all of our lives.
Right.
And I think that that's part of what has been the appeal for so long, is there aren't many companies that for 100 years have been
capturing the imagination of
every human
being on the planet. Yeah, it's remarkable. It really is. And I think that letter on your wall from Michael Eisner, which is
so
true,
embarrassing.
I mean, that really is, it's another part of the story that I don't think people realize, which makes me so happy for you that you are getting to be a part of Disney in this way. And clearly they love you. It's mutual.
Thank you.
So you go through that experience of Frozen. And so was there another, like, how do I top this? Is this in the moment?
Yeah, or? Yeah. I mean, you know, so after Frozen, it becomes, there's, oh my God, I hit the jackpot again. And now I have to make the right decisions. But what I didn't want to have happen was to fall into, repetition. So I was lucky enough to read this incredible script called The Wedding Ringer by Jeremy Gerlich, starring Kevin Hart. And I was obsessed with Kevin. And I thought, you know, what a great way to sort of venture out and do like an R-rated comedy, something people wouldn't necessarily, think of me for. And so,
was this character based on me?
No, that character was not based on you.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's all right.
Not all of them will be based on New Glory. Every 3 years, I'll base one.
So only the ones that are cultural phenomenons.
So I did this movie, and then, you know, again, I started getting a lot of comedy opportunities, Pixels, right, and, you know, different stuff. And I was, once again, I was very grateful for that opportunity and thrilled that I got to play with people who, frankly, I admire the hell out of, from Adam Sandler, who we grew up watching, right, too, Kevin. But again, I started to feel like I was falling into this, you know, trap of doing the same thing again and again. And so one day I, you know, sort of said to my team, I want to shake things up a little bit. I want the stuff that I'm doing to really challenge me, because I feel like a lot of this I'm so grateful to do and I want to keep doing it, but I'm worried that I'm going to bore my audience because I'm doing the same thing over and over. And so I started reading a lot of interesting scripts. I was lucky enough to be, going back to even Beauty and the Beast, I was lucky enough to be offered Beauty and the Beast, and it was a great opportunity to sort of marry these different skill sets that I did, which I hadn't been able to. We don't get many opportunities to do a live action musical.
Right.
You've done one, you know, in Dreamgirls. I have never had the opportunity to do it. So, you know, Beauty and the Beast came along, this small drama called Marshall, which is coming out this fall, Murder on the Orient Express. And, you know, along the way, I did movies like Thanks for Sharing and Love and Other
Ladies
Drugs.
Ladies and gentlemen, I just want you to know that when you hear that banging, it's not your
eardrums,
your car.
I'm sorry.
Josh is very animated in real life as well, and he needs to keep using his hands.
I have a gavel in my hand, which I'm banging right now. So, you know, it was, for me, I'm at this new phase in my career where, well, I'm still doing the stuff that I've always done and, you know, continuing to bring animated characters to life and do comedies. I'm looking for opportunities to challenge myself, challenge my audiences, and you know, and I'm desperate to get back into stage. I'm desperate to do, you know, what you're doing again, because I really miss it. I really do.
Isn't it? It's amazing to me, and I you know, like that. You know, you, Andrew, a bunch of folks that I know who've been in Broadway and who've had this tremendous success in TV and film, the enthusiasm and want to go back to Broadway or be back on stage. Obviously, I get it. I love being on stage, but I feel like it actually fuels me more being in this show and being a part of this, to just enjoy every second of it, because everyone who's away from it for a period of time
wants to be
right, back, wants to be there. And of course, you know, everyone on Broadway wants to be able to have a TV and film career and to be able, because honestly, that's a way to have a better Broadway career, is if you're in a TV or film show. But it's the draw is so strong for you, for so many of us. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's nothing like it. I mean, there's nothing. It is the most gratifying. It's the most energetic. It's the most challenging. It's everything that, you know, we have trained for. And when you spend so much of your life on a stage,
right,
getting off that stage is, you go through withdrawal. Mm-hmm. You really do. And for me, there's nothing as pure, there's nothing as energizing, like I said, as being on a stage and sharing that intimacy with an audience, going on that journey together. You see, I have a stack over there. We're recording this in my office. There's hundreds of playbills of different shows that I've been fortunate to see And every one of those experiences as an audience member was as profound for me as I'm sure it was enjoyable for the performer themselves, mm-hmm. right? And so to be a part of that relationship, that give and take, is something that I desperately long for again. And, you know, I know that eventually I will get back, but it's 5 years, going on 5 years now since I've put my foot on a stage. It's getting
harder and harder.
Right? 4 or 5 years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we opened, Mormon was the last time you were on a stage?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, you left in summer of 2012. So it'll be 5 years
this summer. It'll be 5 years.
Yeah. Wow.
Producers, if you're listening, please call me. I'm ready.
Oh, please.
I'm ready.
The producers are calling.
I'm ready.
You know, like, I mean, I think that the hard part is that when you do something like Book of Mormon, how do you follow that up?
Well, apparently, if you're you or Andrew, you do Hamilton.
Well,
the
I
biggest
did
show of all time.
But I didn't. I mean, the first things I did was 2 off Broadway shows, A Little Miss Sunshine and Nobody Loves You at Second Stage, right. Which was like in that first like 6 months after I left the show, which was great because it was kind of like under the radar
also
and
did,
not too much.
What was it? Was it 2 Gentlemen? What did you do at La
Comedy Lafoya? Of Errors.
Comedy of Errors.
Yes.
Which you were incredible in.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I mean, I was able to do a lot of other theater off of Broadway. But I think that I always end up talking about nerds, that whole thing. And I should talk about it with you because you were there when I got the email.
I like to take a little bit of credit.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm not in Hamilton if I'm not in
nerds.
Accepting nerds. Yeah. So it was January 22nd of 2016, and you and I were in a Starbucks.
We were talking about your show.
Working on a show that I was writing about singing musicals in my basement as a kid, which I ended up doing at 54 Below last year. And I get an email on a Friday saying, hey, this is an offer for you to play Bill Gates.
And what did I say?
Nerds. And you flipped out. Yeah. I said, I don't think this is real. I said, I didn't even know this was coming to Broadway. And you were like, there was an article in Deadline.
Yeah, I read about
it. You've got to do this. You freaked out.
I did.
And I couldn't stop laughing. And remember, I was like, I have to respond back to the director about getting the script and the music, and you wrote the email.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was too nervous to write the email. That's me with Jeffrey Katzenberg. I get an offer for something, and I'm too nervous to even reply on an email.
I knew that it was the perfect marriage, and I was like, and it really does all work out brilliantly. Like, you know, you don't do that show, you never get Hamilton.
No, and it's funny because it almost just became a huge audition for me,
right?
To show what I how you know, because as much as I loved getting to do Elder McKinley, it really was not even a song; it was like a portion of a
right.
song, you know, leading a big group number. And so to get to lead a show and have a casting director, Bethany Knox from Telsey, cast nerds, and then see me do a run through the day after we're canceled. That's why she called me 2 days later to be in Hamilton.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's insane. And you were definitely the person who not forced me to do nerds, but you have a way of like giving your opinion that is so black and white. Like there's
it
no,
is.
It's it, you
I,
were like you would be an idiot not to do this.
I'm
it's just
all
like,
hyperbole.
Yeah, when we graduated. Mm-hmm. And I told you that I was moving to Los Angeles. You said you are an idiot.
I was right.
So mad at you.
I was right.
You were not right.
I
got my
right.
my equity card in LA. I know that I'm here living in LA now because I had those first few years out of college learning what it was. And that's how I met Gary Marshall, worked at that theater for years. You were wrong.
I was right. I still contend that you would have hit stardom much earlier had you listened to me.
No, but I mean, it's definitely crazy that we were sitting in a Starbucks when that happened. So
that's the other thing that I want to say, by the way, about living the dream. You can't live the dream alone.
Right.
Friendship, it is, I think, the most important thing, because you need people to fall on. You right. need shoulders to cry on and, you know, bodies to celebrate with. And
people who understand.
And people who understand. And through thick and thin, you know, you and I have always been in each other's lives during the greatest ups and the lowest downs, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that that is so important. And I think that a group that you can surround yourself with of people who share the same, you know, pitfalls and high moments that's as important as any of the other stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that it takes a little while to get past and learn how the reality is that other people's success is not your failure. Other people's journey is not your failure, but you need to be beside them and with them when...
What is that?
That's my jingle.
Why is it telling you that?
That's my jingle. So like it's all being recorded on a GarageBand and it just started to go off. It's basically like telling me it's been an hour. So it just went off in my headset. You're like, what is that?
Well, I just don't understand why somebody's singing in your headphones.
Someone, it's me. no, I was going to say that you learn that other people's success is not your failure, and also that you need to be there for your friends, not just for their downtimes and their failures, but you need to actually be a support system through their success.
Oh yeah.
That some of my highest points is when I've needed my friends, when I've needed Gerald, when I've needed, because the fear and the you can feel a little alienated or like, I don't know. It's scary.
It is scary. And there's nothing like the validation of the people you know closest or the criticism of the people you know closest. You know, right. you want that honesty. Mm. I always want you to tell me you know, you could do better or you're coasting, you know, whether it's you or Seth or whoever is in my life, especially Ida, my wife, she yeah. wastes no time telling me when I suck. But it's important to remind people of what they can do, what they are capable of.
Who they are yeah. and why they're in it. Yeah, it's tough. It gets easier in a lot of ways as you go, but it also gets more complicated. You know, as, you know, before we end here is like, I think that another thing that I'll say that's nice is you have
so hard
created
for you.
It's very hard.
I know, I can see it.
You've created this wonderful family. Oh. And you know, you got married in 2008. Mm-hmm. So you've been married for a while. You have two beautiful daughters who, you know, I'm obsessed with, who are just the most amazing people. And you're a wonderful dad, a great husband, and that's always been something that's more impressive and inspiring to me, way more than anything you've done professionally. And I think, you know, especially for a podcast like this, that the thing that scared me most when I got out of school and realized that I was, how difficult it was going to be as an actor, wasn't that I wasn't going to be able to live my dream as a performer being on stage. It was, oh my God, am I going to be able to have a family? Am I going to be able to afford
right.
to raise a child and do this? Like that just seemed crazy to me. How do you feel like you were able to, I mean, obviously, you know, the more success you have, the easier it is, but really when you got married and there were things happening, but it's scary always, right? It's always scary. And it's especially like, I think that with what we do, there's always this fear. And as Gerald and I are in this, you know, moment in time where we really want to start a family, I feel pretty secure, but I'm like, my God, I'm an actor. This is crazy that I'm going to bring a child into my home, and how am I going to provide for it till it's 18 and beyond?
Never stops being scary. You know, I think that a bigger factor than I ever considered, you know, nobody can teach you that in school, but one of the biggest factors in making decisions in your life becomes your kids.
Right.
And how will your decisions affect them? You know, I was just away for 3 months shooting a movie in England.
Right.
It's not easy, you know, and it takes a toll. And so it's about balance. But I think in general, you know, you go where the best opportunities are and you have to work with what you got and right. figure out, then I'll fly home on the weekends. Or, you know, you're here right now in Los Angeles knowing full well that you got to get back on a plane tomorrow to do a show tomorrow night. Right. I'm sure that takes a toll physically. And so it's, you make those commitments, you make those sacrifices in some cases because you have to balance it.
Right. Yeah. And it's worth it. Like, it's what it's all for. I feel like at the end of the day, I'm always drawn to people in our business who have a really strong family connection, because I think that they're not just happier, but they have better careers because they're choosing things out of love and for the right reasons. And I don't know. I think that has been a part of your success, is that you know what's most important in life. And I think that comes across to audiences, that you are a joyful person and that you... The kid who loves Disney and understands the power of human connection in that way from a young age is someone who can communicate to an audience and make them laugh. I was so proud to watch you. I was by myself watching Beauty and the Beast and the belly laughs that you were getting in that theater. And to think that, you know, that kid who had the Michael Eisner letter on his wall was getting the biggest laughs in a Disney major motion picture. I don't know. It's crazy. And I think that hopefully you can feel that more, because I know when you're in it, it's hard to like really feel it. Hopefully through my eyes and through my experience, you can feel that more. And that's...
I never stop pinching myself, as I'm sure you do too. I mean, I remember calling you one night when Obama came to see your show and just being like, the president of the United States of America at the time, won't make any political comments right now, but the president of the United States came to see your show.
Well, Hillary came and twice.
Hillary came and
yeah,
everybody.
Obama didn't come when I was there.
Well then
did you call Leslie?
And then I called Leslie. I confuse you guys so much.
I know. We look a lot alike.
But who was it that came? Or Beyonce? Somebody came when you were there that I was like, how? Like, you're meeting
the craziest people
in the world.
You called me a few times when people were coming.
See Instagram pictures.
Yeah.
Like
Paul McCartney. I think that's you. That got a call from you.
But like, you're living the dream. Yeah. Like, we are living the dream.
Yeah.
And I'm disappointed that you didn't meet Obama now. I'm actually...
You are.
I actually feel like I lost a little respect.
I actually joined the cast a week after they all got to go to the White House.
Oh, right. He came like 3 times too. That's got to suck, Rory.
I know. He's going to go back now that I'm not there. I'm going to get him to come to the LA production.
I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud that we get to take this journey together. And I love that you finally put me on this podcast. What episode is this?
This is the final episode of...
Just Touche.
No, it is. I don't know what it. It's probably like 22.
Only took 22.
Only 22. That's where you about where you are on my list of people. No, I'm really glad that you not only that you did it, but that you want to do it. Obviously, Josh, you were one of the first people that I wanted to talk to. But I wanted this is also something that I'm learning how to do is talk to people and how to listen to them and like what this is. And you know, I knew that you were someone who was going to be great, and it clearly was a very interesting conversation. And I'd love to have another one again, check in a year.
Absolutely, I'd love that.
And see how you're doing.
It's going to be called Living the Nightmare.
Yeah, I'll have to come up with a new jingle. All right, love you.
Love you.
Audition side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.